It is time for Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio, our on-air segment as well as our podcast, where we get a chance to check in with our liberal commentator, Air Brown, and our conservative commentator, Chuck Marone. A lot of times we pose questions about how things work, but in this month's episode, we want to talk about how things could work or what is working. Chuck, Aaron, thanks for being here.
Good to be here. New year, new problems.
Yeah, happy new year. Thanks for having us back.
You're welcome. So let's talk about this idea. It's come up before in our conversations about universal basic income. Who wants to begin? And let's just hear what this concept is.
Well, the idea behind basic income, sometimes called universal income, is that you have a system by which every citizen personally receives some kind of monetary compensation, usually in lieu of other social programs that a government might put together. So, for instance, right now, you don't get anything, right? If you are a taxpayer, you pay your taxes and you earn your income through work, and that's the exclusive arrangement. Well, we also know that some people are eligible for certain benefits for health insurance. Some people are eligible for disability benefits, and other people are eligible for Social Security. And these are all costly programs that the people deem necessary to operate a society. Well, the idea behind universal income is that income becomes a freeing thing for a population. If people can count on an income through the wealth of a nation, then that frees them up to do other things. Take other work is how most people would, but also would free them up to open businesses or do more work in their communities. It would take away this pressure that a lot of people feel, and I think especially a lot of people on the lower end of the spectrum of income feel, that they have to go out and scrap out a living for every rent check, for every gallon of gas, etc. And it's actually being tested in a number of countries around the world. Finland is in the middle of a big experiment right now. Canada is experimenting with it in areas and parts of Scotland. I believe the city of Glasgow is, I believe, experimenting with it right now. And we don't know the results of these yet, but this is a concept that you hear discussed not only by liberals who would support your average benefits program, but also it's got some backing in the business world among CEOs and people who have other ideas for it.
And let me just kind of, at the start of this conversation, kind of bolster some of the assertions that Aaron's made. I do think that we're in this time of economic transition. We are, you know, very much like the Industrial Revolution changed the way Americans live, the way we worked. You know, we were largely an agrarian economy before this. By the time you get done with, you know, decades of change, we have more people living in cities, fewer people living on farms. It was complete social upheaval, really, that went about. We're in the same kind of transition, and technology is driving a lot of this. The way we work, the way we live, our general affluence, there's a lot of things that are forcing change. And I think the question, particularly the question that a lot of conservatives are asking themselves now, is what is the best way to have that change and have it continue at a good pace, not hinder it, but also address some of the impacts of that. And the impacts of that, you know, right now we have an old, what I'm going to call antiquated kind of social safety net. We have some very Industrial Revolution kind of ways of dealing with this. Is there a way to modernize that system to be more equitable, more fair, but also I think more responsive and more flexible for people, kind of consistent with a modern economic system?
Is universal income more of a conservative type of idea, or how would you guys describe that?
Well, I think the politics of it would depend on how it was implemented. And Chuck and I have talked about this before. You know, the liberal version of universal income is everybody gets a Social Security check from the federal government on a regular interval, and people count on that income and can then be free to do what they would outside of that. And I don't know, Chuck, maybe you want to describe another method.
I think the most compelling, if you want to call it a conservative version of the universal income, was described by Milton Friedman. And he basically called it a reverse income tax or a negative income tax. Essentially, you would have a minimum income that was guaranteed. And as you went below that income, you would get a check from the government. And as you went above that income, you would start to be taxed. And so essentially, if you chose not to work at all, you would be guaranteed a minimum amount of money. As you worked, most of the money that you made would come to you. It would lower the amount from essentially the check that you received or the subsidy that you received. And as you hit that minimum guaranteed income, essentially when you hit it, and let's call it $40,000 a year, just for a rough number, if you made $40,000 a year, you would neither pay taxes nor receive a check. As you went over $40,000, you'd start to pay in. As you went under it, you would start to get a check. And the reason it was set up that way, or the reason he envisioned it that way, is it creates for people below that amount, there's still an incentive to work. You gain by working. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't remove that incentive. But it also sets a minimum threshold whereby people don't fall below. And that has kind of been in conservative think tanks and conservative circles kind of floated as a really good alternative that would meet those objectives of having a very flexible economy, a safety net while we're transitioning, but also not a huge government bureaucracy that would go along with it.
One of the things that's interesting about this issue is, for me, it feels like the one issue where you can get conservatives and liberals at the table to talk about it, out of all the issues in the political realm right now. And I think part of that is the shared recognition of really a coming crisis when it comes to employment in this country. We're watching, and we've been talking about this on our podcast a lot of different ways, but whether it's automation producing productivity, which is good, but also reducing numbers of jobs, which is bad, or whether it's the shift of the whole economy away from a production-based kind of system to a more service-oriented economy, all of these it creates lots of jobs that by capitalistic or market-based logic can't or shouldn't pay too much, because certain things could be replaced by automated robots and other efficiencies. On the other hand, people who do those jobs, and they are necessary, need to make a living somehow. They need to provide for a family and housing. And so we're stuck kind of in between a shift in the economy, and a lot of people are stuck paycheck to paycheck trying to make a go of it. And the two parties or the two political schools of thought are approaching this differently, one on the market side, one on the support side. But universal basic income is a way of talking about a way into the new economy, the one that's coming. And really, it's advocated not only by some of the governments that I mentioned, more liberal, social democratic kind of governments, but you see guys like entrepreneurs like Mark Cuban and Elon Musk. I know Chuck is no huge fan of Elon Musk, but these entrepreneurial characters trying to create new products and new systems for the way business and the way people are going to live in the future, they talk about it a lot too. And they, I think, the reason that certainly Mark Cuban talks about is about automation. And the fact that a third of the American workforce is poised to lose their jobs if automation is fully implemented by 2025. And so we're not far away from this point. This is, I think, what the motivation is. The question is, and I'll put this out there, this is what they're talking about in Finland. They're in the middle of this experiment. And Finland, like a lot of European countries with strong social democratic safety nets, I guess you'd say, is going through the strain of when the safety net grows, you have to figure out how to modernize it, and you run into the problems with the bureaucracy and things like that. And so they have rising conservative movements in places like Finland and Sweden. And it's not just spending, it's also immigration is a huge issue in those countries as well, just like it is here. But in Finland, they're actually asking the question, will this universal basic income do what it's supposed to do? And this is what it's supposed to do: encourage investment, help people save money for retirement and just in general? Will it increase community volunteerism? Will it help people start businesses? And will it actually get people to update their skills for the new economy? In other words, with all this time and this help with the money, can people then go to college and not just go to college to go to college, but train for something that fits this new economy, update their skills for this new economy? What people are worried about there, and we'll see when the numbers come in, is that there's a chance that it would just allow people with low-income jobs to subsist on low-income jobs. And that's really not the state that you want to create.
I hear you on that last point. I think one of the big issues, and you see this a little bit in Finland, but I think more so in the U.S., where we have this very strange relationship with the social safety net. We kind of have this broad consensus that we're going to have a safety net, but that it's going to really be crappy. You know, it's not going to work real well. So, like, if you look at unemployment, for example, we're going to provide you unemployment benefits. You know, we'll do that, but for a very short period of time. So if you lose your job, you better go out and find
another. And with a ton of rules and regulations attached to them as
well. Yeah, a whole bunch of things attached to it. So I think a lot of conservatives are uncomfortable with the notion of just giving up on all that. Like, no, you don't have to go look for a job. No, you will let unemployment benefits run forever. There's a lot of moral hazard that comes with that that I think, you know, really bothers people who want a system with feedback and a system that functions. What the minimum income does, and I think this is the controversial thing in an American context, from a conservative standpoint, it would get rid of a lot of those programs. Like, we would no longer need unemployment insurance. We would no longer need food stamps and WIC programs and the whole, like, series of safety net things that we've created that are bureaucratic programs that I'm going to say in the United States, we do kind of halfway. We don't really do them the way countries that are serious about them. So you don't really get a chance to, like, get out of anything. But yet we have them there and they kind of linger on. The idea would be to have a robust enough basic minimum income where you could say, let's get rid of all that. The tension becomes, and I think this is where you get into a philosophical issue, if you give people money and they choose to buy liquor instead of food, if they choose to not save but to spend it at the casino, if they choose to do so, what happens then? Mm-hmm. Is there a role for the state then? And that's where, when you start to get into the details of how you implement it, I think you start to get into, and it almost crosses the conservative liberal spectrum, because there's liberals who would be fine with that type of freedom if the amount was high enough. But there's a lot of conservatives that want to make sure you can't spend that money at the casino. But I think the way we could find a consensus is to try to attack that particular issue.
I think the attitude around it is, in fact, one of the big issues. In America, we have a very time-tested way of arguing about the welfare state. In fact, calling it the welfare state is, in fact, a tell on a particular kind of argument.
Well, I've been using safety net out of respect for you.
Thank you for that. You know, Democrats use that term, and I'm not saying that you can't say one or the other. I'm just saying that we fall into old patterns in discussing this. But I just wrote about something a few weeks ago that stood out to me, and it's another, I like to look at Sweden. I've had the chance to meet some Swedish journalists, and there's some similarities between Sweden and Minnesota that I kind of find interesting. And one of them is the northern part of Sweden is a lot like the Iron Range. There's iron mining and lumber, and it's a very similar kind of economy to ours, only they're in Sweden and we're in the United States of America. Now, granted, Minnesota is a bit more like Sweden than the rest of the country in terms of its state policies. It's not all, certainly not all the way Swedish. But one of the stories that I followed was the story of automation coming to the mines, the iron mines of northern Sweden. And we have the same thing happening here in northern Minnesota. This was in the New York Times, actually. In Sweden, the unions and the managers of the mines, the owners of the mines, all talk about automation the same way, positively. They say it makes the job safer, it makes the mine more efficient and profitable, and it allows people to seek higher skill levels involving computers and automated systems as opposed to low-skilled positions like shoveling rocks that we once associated with mines. From the person doing the job, and these are talking about 19, 20, 21-year-old young men and women working in the mines in Sweden, they love automation. The big reason that they can love it is because they have protections and they don't have to worry about getting the training to do those jobs. And in fact, I've over the years covered another story in Piteå, Sweden, which is a lumber town. An old family business, four generations of a Swedish lumber company. They used to make trusses and construction frames, this kind of thing. They were losing money just like all the lumber companies in the United States with the change in the wood products economy, just like anywhere else in the world. And they made a dramatic switch, working the owners of the company, working with the workers of the company and the community they were in, got the community college and technical college in their community to train their whole workforce not to build trusses and frames, but to build entire modular buildings, adding value to the, still made out of wood, but adding tremendous value and a lot of skill to what that company did. The company's thriving. And yes, it's expensive to train all those workers, but when you look at the economic benefit, in the long run, it's worked for that little town and it's worked for that company and it's certainly worked for those workers.
When you look at the model in Finland, in Sweden, when you look at particularly a country like Switzerland, I think even more so to the point I'd like to make, one of the things that we're going to have to deal with here as the melting pot that they're just starting to have to deal with here in this, there in the same kind of way is a basic minimum income a social contract among Americans, or is it a social justice issue? And I'm gonna tweak that. I'm going to say that in a little bit more contrast here. Is it an agreement we make amongst ourselves? In other words, I look after you, you look after me, we take care of each other. We're all going to contribute to this system, and essentially we're all going to get something from it. Or is it an issue where, regardless of who you are, where you're from, if you show up here in America, you're part of the system? And I do think, I don't have a firm like belief on that. I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other, but I think I understand both sides of the issue to know that that is going to be a deeply contentious part of moving forward with this. If anybody can show up in the United States at any time and be 100% part of our social contract, that changes it from a social contract to something else. And I do think that a place like Sweden, a place like Finland, has an easier time doing things like this because they haven't dealt with that as much as we do here. We are a country of immigrants. We're a country of new people constantly coming in and renewing. And I think that that's a beautiful part of this country. But it does, when you have these deeply established social contracts that you're changing, it does make those conversations a lot more difficult. The other aspect of this that I think can't really be overlooked, and I'm just going to put this one on the table again without a real resolution in my mind, there are certain people who back in, you know, the early days of mining were really good at shoveling rocks, but were never, ever going to be the foreman and never, ever going to be the person who in today's age would run the automation and the computer. This doesn't make these people unworthy. It doesn't make them bad people. It doesn't make them lesser people. It just makes them people with a different skill set. What do we do about people who today are just not going to thrive in a technology automation age? Is there respectable labor for them to do? And I don't have an answer for that. I really don't know, and I'm not surmising to know, but I do know many of these people, and they're good, decent people. And I don't know in a high productivity world what their future is. I think a basic minimum income might be a way for us to buy some time to figure that out.
I always wonder, what did all the mild-mannered, nearsighted kids do back in the Old West?
Yeah.
Who couldn't have glasses? Like, because I was so nearsighted as a kid. Like, man, if I didn't have glasses, my world would be very different. So, but I think people adapt. And the economy is changing. Our world is changing. That much is evident. And I think we just have to accept that as these changes happen, you know, as Bob Dylan once said, the first will now later be last. And people's position changes. Skills are changing. You know, when the whole government falls and the asteroid hits, people who can shovel rocks are going to be back in. That was too callous, I think.
All right, we'd love for you to weigh
That's
in.
That's trouble. I got in trouble right there.
Universal basic income. What about, we need to end this, but what about health care?
Not to resuscitate the whole topic, but I just had some numbers. In 2035, Social Security insolvency levels off. We have an opportunity to have a stable pay-in 2035, which is also when the GDP, part of GDP assigned to medical care and health care, is up to 14% in the United States.
I think 2035 is the year I get to collect Social Security.
I did the math. No, you're not yet.
Am I not yet?
None of us here
are
going to enjoy anything like the current system.
Right. Okay.
But after 2035, there will be opportunity to rebuild something maybe different, and this might be what it is.
All right, it's Dig Deep. Send us an email, comments@kaxe.org.